So, hello and welcome to our computer graphics lecture. So today we will learn about very basic computer graphic algorithms. We are right now in the section of rasterization. So we already started with this last Thursday. So the problem is quite simple. Given a two-dimensional polygon with n vertices, so usually when we say polygon, we mean triangle, but it can be an arbitrary polygon. And now we want to find out which pixels on a raster display are covered by that triangle. So that's a very basic algorithm. Imagine you have a scene consisting of something like 10 million triangles. All these triangles have been projected to the screen. So you know the extent of that triangle on the screen, and now you have to set all the pixels inside to render that model. Yeah, so if you want to do that for 10 million triangles, this algorithm runs 10 million times per frame. And if you want to have 60 frames, this algorithm runs 600 million times per second. Yeah, so it is very, very important that it's very fast. And for interactive graphics at least. And the algorithms that we will learn here are not the ones that are implemented on a GPU or something. But they are the basis for it. And of course, there are many little secrets how these algorithms can be optimized and so on. So we will learn about the very basic versions, and there are optimizations, many optimizations, further optimizations possible. Okay, and the first one. It's more a kind of introduction, because maybe that's the first thing you would think about if you hear about that problem, is to use the so-called seed fill algorithm. And the idea here is that we first rasterize the boundary of the polygon. We will see later on how this can be done very efficiently. And then we do a flood fill from the center or from a point inside the polygon. And this flood fill can be implemented easily using recursion. Easily means it's simple to implement. So here you see the entire code for doing that flood fill. And what it essentially does, it is always called for a particular pixel, and it just tests whether this pixel already has been set. If yes, then we are done. Otherwise, we set the pixel and we call the procedure recursively for all four neighbors. Yeah? So that's very simple to implement, but as we saw here for this very simple example, where just a 3x6 rectangle had to be filled, we see that the recursion goes very, very, very deep. Yeah? It's like a snake crawling through these pixels. Here here is the first time. I don't need to go through that once again. It's just recursion goes very deep, essentially for each of these pixels we make one recursion, so recursion depth is very deep. Okay, so simple to implement, but not really practical. And in particular, another problem is that we only set the pixels inside, but it's difficult to also shade these pixels. We will later on see with other algorithms that for these it's quite simple to integrate, also to compute color gradients, etc., on these interior pixels. Okay, so that's more theoretical way, or a nice algorithm because it's so simple to implement, but less practical. Another algorithm that we will look at now is the 2D scan line algorithm, and it's a direct algorithm to more efficiently enumerate all the pixels within such a polygon. And how could that work? Again, a more theoretical algorithm, but just to introduce the overall idea. So such a triangle is a rather simple shape. It's not difficult to describe it geometrically with a simple Boolean expression. So the typical way would be that we take each of the edges of the triangle, we define a half space by each of these edges. That means we define a half space that describes every, or that contains every point on the right of this edge, for instance, on top of this edge, and below this edge. Yeah? And the triangle is just the intersection of all all three of this. That means, and in the exercises, in the tutorials, I think you heard about these half spaces, so that's quite simple to describe. You can take any point on the edge, and then the normal of this half space, and then a particular point here is, or on which side of this half edge this point is, can simply be computed with a dot product, x minus p, scalar product with n. If this is larger than 0, in that case we are on this side. If it's less than 0, we are on this side, and if it's equal to 0, we are on the edge. Yeah? So that's very, very basic math. So each of these edges can be transformed to such an expression, which is not very difficult to evaluate, two products and a sum, and then just the result needs to be compared with 0, and if we do that for all three edges, we get a rather simple expression that tells us whether we are whether a particular point is inside the triangle or not. And now, of course, what we could do is that we enumerate all pixels, we iterate over all pixels of our screen, and for each pixel we find out whether it's inside the triangle or not. Yeah? So that would be an algorithm, but of course, typically our triangles are much smaller than the entire screen, so that would be very, very wasteful. Yeah? Because most of the pixels are outside the triangle. Okay, but nevertheless, it's a valid algorithm for each pixel. Then we check for each edge of our triangle whether x, y is on the wrong side of E. If this is the case, then we can immediately continue. So if we find one edge where the pixel is outside this edge, then we can immediately continue. We don't need to continue with the other edges, and then we are done. Yeah, and if it survives all these three tests, then we set the pixel. Okay, so that's very, very simple, very basic. Of course, if we have a very small triangle, then this will be very wasteful, but there's a very obvious way to do that better, and that is to compute a bounding box of that triangle. So that means we compute a window on the screen that is just big enough to guarantee that the triangle is completely inside that window, and then we only have to iterate over that window. And for each of these pixels within the window, we make a test whether we're inside the triangle or not. Now, this is already a quite efficient algorithm, and I'm pretty sure that most of you have a renderer using that algorithm in your pocket, because it's a typical algorithm that's used on mobile devices for rendering. In variants, yeah, but essentially this idea is used there. Okay, yeah, so finding this bounding box is very simple. You just need to find the minimum and maximum values of the x and y coordinates. That gives you this bounding box, and then just have to iterate. Okay, but nevertheless, it's still a bit wasteful, in particular if you don't have triangles but more complex polygons. Things become a bit more complicated. And the question is, how can we further improve that? And one idea is the following. We will learn later on about line rasterization, how we can fill lines between two points. And if we're able to do so, we could further improve that. So we could, for instance, rasterize this line and this line, and then always fill from the left boundary to the right boundary. Yeah, always just simply fill these scan lines. At this point, we have to kind of stop, because this edge is done now. and we have to switch to this edge. Yeah, but at least for a triangle, the number of possible cases is not too many. So yeah, we could find a solution for that. And yeah, by this we really have a very efficient way to enumerate all the pixels here in between. And yeah, in fact, this is the core idea of our scanline algorithm. And so again, the idea is we proceed scanline for scanline. Yeah, so we go through the scanlines from top to bottom or from bottom to top. That doesn't make a difference. And for each of these scanlines, we find the intersections with our triangle or with our polygon, and then we fill always from left to right. Yeah? So that's very simple for a triangle. Yeah, if we look at this scanline, here it intersects the triangle and here it does intersect, so we just fill all the pixels between the first and the second intersection. Now, this works also for more complicated polygons, even for self-intersecting cases like this one. Yeah, it works. The only difference to here is that in certain regions we don't have two intersections but four. Yeah, and so we always fill from the first to the second and from the third to the fourth and so on. Yeah, of course you can generate even more intersections. Yeah, it's just a question of your fantasy. And you can also generate very weird cases like this one. I mean, that's a polygon. Yeah, it has a number of vertices, P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, 6, 7, and 8. And yeah, if we now take this interpretation here, what this would result in is that it fills this region, and it leaves this here open. Yeah, that's a kind of hole in the polygon. So because our scan line here intersects here, 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 and here, and we would fill, yeah, from the first to the second, and from the third to the fourth, and so this remains unset. Yeah. Now that's a question of how to define what is inside and outside such a polygon, and this is a typical way to interpret that. Yeah? But typically, yeah, you don't want to have such polygons, and essentially, we always think about triangles. Okay, so yeah, that's a simple first approach, and yeah, now how can we do this a bit more efficiently? And now this is just one possibility to describe that. We first generate a list of edges, yeah, or a table with all the edges of our triangle. And for each of these triangles, we store a number of values, yeah, a description of this edge. So we first store the starting point of that edge. And the reason is, okay, yeah, we go through the scanlines from bottom to top. Yeah, that means we start with this scanline here. Yeah, that's the first one intersecting the triangle. And yeah, you will see, you immediately see that this and this edge are the first one we are intersecting. Yeah, so the first information from these edges is their starting point. And starting point in this case means their lower point, the bottom point. So that's the first information that we store per edge. And then, of course, we need information about the slope of that edge. Yeah? How we can proceed from here to the end point. And yeah, so we could immediately store this end point, but instead we store something different. We store information delta x and delta y. Yeah, so that defines the slope, and we don't really store the slope, but instead the reciprocal of the slope. We will see later on why we do so. Yeah, so this is the slope of this edge, and we store information where this edge is done, where it finishes, and that's the upper bound of that edge. Yeah. So that's just, it's very simple to transform the coordinates pi and pi plus 1 to this representation. It's just a different way to store all the information about the edge. Okay, yeah, so we transform all edges into this representation. That's very simple. And we store all these edges in a list. And we immediately sort this list according to the y of the lower point, according to y lower. Why? I mean, it's obvious. If we go from bottom to top through these Ken lines, yeah, the edges will become of interest, yeah, according to their y lower. Yeah? The later it begins, the later it becomes of interest. Yeah? So when going from bottom to top, we immediately can get in all the edges we need. Okay, so that's step number one. We have this edge table. And now next, we have a list of edges that are currently, or that are intersecting the current scan line. We call this the active edge table, AET. And now this, let me go back here. So if, for instance, this is our current scan line, yeah, the active edge table contains this edge and this edge. These are the two edges intersecting the scan line. Yeah? And when going from bottom to top, we will remove edges from the active edge table when we reach the y lower, and we will add new ones, yeah, when we get so far up that a new edge becomes of interest. So it's quite simple to update this active edge tables. And for each of these edges in the active edge table, we store, well, the most important part is the intersection of this edge with a current line, with a current scan line. So in this case, this x value and this x value, yeah? They define the point of where the polygon is entered and where the polygon is exited. So these two values we store in the active edge table. So that's this intersection point of x. Then we have to remember y upper, because that tells us when we can remove an edge from the active edge table. Yeah, and we also store this value here, the reciprocal slope, and we will see the reason in a second. One more remark, this active edge table should ideally be sorted according to x intersect, so from left to right, because by this we can most easily find the pairs of intersections that we have to fill. Yeah, so this would be the first edge in the intersection active edge table, this the second, this the third, and this the fourth. Yeah? So we just take the intersect values of the first and fill to the second, and from the third and fill to the fourth, and so on. Okay, and now finally there's this one value here, and yeah, probably you already realized what it is for. The idea now is, the idea now is that this is exactly the value by which we have to update x intersect if we move up one scan line. Yeah? If we have an edge that looks like this, now this is scan line y, and now we go up to y plus 1, yeah? Then x intersect, which is still here, now at this position is x intersect plus, yeah, exactly this value, delta x over delta y. Yeah? But we will see that in a minute on the slide. So this simply tells us how we can update x intersect if we go to the next scan line. Okay, now, but first of all, for a practical example how that looks like, we have this simple polygon here with four vertices, P1 to P4. That means we have four edges shown here. And these edges we store or are stored in the order first P3, P4, because so these two edges have the same Y lower, so they must be the first in the list. Whether this one is the first or this one is the first doesn't matter. So we start, let's first take P3, P4. This has a starting point X3, Y3, so that's just the coordinates of this point. It finishes at Y upper, this is Y4, the Y coordinate of this point, and the reciprocal slope is this value here, that's delta X, this distance to the over this distance. Yeah, so that's a representation of this edge. Additionally, as next one, we have P3, P2, that's this edge. Again, similar values. Then we have P4, P1 here, and P2, P1, this one. So we assume they start at the same Y, so again, the order doesn't make a difference. Yeah, so that's a kind of pre-processing that we have to do. There's nothing complicated, yeah? It's just storing the values in a more convenient order. Okay, and now we proceed from the bottom of our polygon upwards, and the current scan line we call Y scan, and all the edges intersecting with the current scan line are now taken out of the edge table and moved to the active edge table. Yeah, and yeah, that's quite simple. Yeah. Whenever Y scan becomes larger than the lower or Y lower of an edge, then we remove this edge from the edge table and move it to the active edge table. Yeah. And whenever Y scan becomes larger than the upper bound of an edge, we remove it from the edge, active edge table and simply throw it away. Yeah. So in the beginning we have a edge table, there are all edges in it, and then one after the other, these edges are taken from the edge table to the active edge table. They are used for rendering until the scan line gets out of the scope of this edge, and then this edge is removed. And in the end, both tables are empty, and we are done. Yeah. So, if now in this example here, this is Y scan, yeah, and for this scan line, our active edge table looks like this. So we have edge P3, P2 here. The current intersection with the scan line is here, x prime. Yeah, so that's the x value of the intersection. The y value is y scan. Y2 is the upper bound here. And this is, again, the reciprocal slope. And now here, the order is important. P3, P2 is before P3, P4, because this table is sorted for these x values. Yeah? So because this intersection is before this intersection, first this edge is stored, and then this edge is stored. OK, so x prime is this intersection, and x prime prime is this second intersection here. And again, the upper bound is y4, and this is the other reciprocal slope. So we have these two edges in the active edge table. And okay, so this is the kind of current state for this scan line. And if we now proceed to the next scan line, now we go upwards. What do we have to do? First of all, we have to update these x values. Yeah. So if we go upwards, now we have here a new x value, and here we have another new x value. And this can be done incrementally, yeah, by simply adding this value to x prime. Yeah. So going to the next scan line means simply adding this to this and adding this to this for all the edges in the active edge table. Yeah. And this gives us the new x prime and x prime prime, the x-intersection values. Yeah, so that's quite simple to derive by just taking the line equations for these edges. So the old value is the distance in y direction times 1 over m plus the starting x. And if we now increase the scan line by 1, you immediately see that 1 over m, yeah, this one here has a prefactor of 1 over m. So this new x is just the old x plus 1 over m. It's very simple. Yeah?
In your example at the board, what would m be? Because the edges okay. are
So, do you mean this example here?
No, at the left side of the
board. Ah, okay. Okay, that's a very good point. So, there will be slides later on, but doesn't matter. If you have a horizontal edge, yeah, in that case delta x, yeah, is a normal value and delta y is 0, yeah, so this here would be infinity, yeah, but the point is that that this line never has an intersection with your scan line, yeah, unless you have the extraordinary case here. But even in that case, you can quickly see that you can solve this by simply removing these edges. Don't considering these edges at all. Yeah? So you can simply, when generating the edge table, horizontal edges can simply be removed. They don't contribute. Yeah? We will see that later on a slide.
So what about the other special case when there are more than two intersecting edges?
Yeah. This here? Okay, that's no problem. In that case, you have four edges in your edge table. They are all sorted for their x values. Yeah, and then you have to fill from x of the first edge to the second, and from the third to the fourth, and so on. Yeah, as long as you have simple triangles or more general convex polygons. Yeah, you will always only have two edges in the active edge table, but for more complicated shapes, it can be more. Okay. Yeah, so very simple. Yeah, when we now go up with a scan line, we simply have to increase the intersection value this just by this value 1 over m. Okay, now we have all little pieces, essentially, and now the entire algorithm is not very complicated. Let me try to describe or to bring things together. So first, we initialize the edge table. Yeah, so that's not detailed out here, but it's simple. Then we set the active edge table to empty. And then we initialize the active edge table by setting y scan, that's the y coordinate of the scan line, we set this to the y lower of the first entry in the edge table. Yeah, this is the lowest edge, and we take the y lower of the lowest edge. And in fact, it's not only the first entry in the edge table, but also the second will have this y lower. It must have, because otherwise the polygon is not closed. Yeah, it must have two edges that start at the lowest point. And this minimum y we take as y scan, and then we immediately take all edges from the edge table that start at that lowest scan line to the active edge table. So typically this will be 2, but of course it might happen that you have something like this. Yeah, then you have 4 edges immediately in the active edge table. Okay, so, and then we continue. As long as the edge table is not empty, as long as we still have edges intersecting our scan line, yeah, we resort the active edge table for x. Yeah, we sort all the entries in the active edge table for x, and we should resort because there are cases like this one. It's a bit exotic, yeah, but if we go from this can line to this can line, you see that this edge, which here is third, now becomes second, and this one, which was second, becomes third. Yeah, so it can happen that they intersect and that we really have to resort. And of course, we have to resort if we add new edges. Yeah? Okay, so we resort, then we draw lines from the first to the second and from the third to the fourth and so on. So that's a simple loop. And now this is the loop where the pixels are set. Yeah? This is now really enumerate all the pixels in the scan line that intersect the polygon. That's the core part. This is where we set our pixels. Okay, and now we have to proceed to the next scan line. That first means we remove all edges for which this was the last scan line. Yeah? Or we remove all edges which won't intersect the next scan line anymore, just because the endpoint is below. Yeah, so we remove edges from the edge table, but of course we also have to add new edges. Before we do that, we update all the remaining edges, the x-coordinate. Yeah, so that's simply adding, as I showed, 1 over m to x, so that's a simple loop over the active edges. And then we add all edges from the edge table that now become of interest, yeah, whether the scan line overlaps now. We take all these new edges from the edge table and add them to the active edge table. Yeah? So the edge table becomes smaller and smaller. The active edge table typically has a size of 2. And in the end, all the edges have been removed from the edge table and from the active edge table, and then we are done. Yeah? As long as the edge table not empty or the active edge table not empty. And of course, we have to increase y scan by 1. Okay, yeah, so that's a very, very simple basic algorithm. We can look at an example, yet another example. Here we have this polygon. We have edges E1, E2, E3, E4, and E5. And by just taking the coordinates and transforming this to an edge table, we get this here, yeah? And so these are all the edges with lower coordinates and whatever, yeah? So that's just another description of the polygon. Then we sort this table according to their lower y coordinate. So you see the order gets a bit changed. 1, 2, 4, 3, 5. Look at this. 1 and 2, yeah, they have this point, this lower point, so they must be first. Then the next one is E4. This has this lower point. And then we have two edges with this lower point, 3 and 5. Yeah? So that's this order. It's just a simple resorting. Then we start with the first scan line. That's the lower coordinate here, y lower, of the first edge. This is 1. Yeah? So our first scan line is 1. We move all edges that intersect from the edge table to the active edge table. So E1 and E2 arrive in the active edge table, and the edge table becomes smaller. Yeah? And in sum, we still have 5. Nothing else happened here. And in the end, we also immediately fill all the pixels from, and now we go to the active edge table, and we fill from x of the first to the x value of the second. So we fill the pixels from pixel 1, x equals 1, to x equals 1, so we set this 1 pixel. Yeah, that's it. Okay, now we proceed to the next scan line. We increase y. That means that the x values are updated. So here, for this line, this update is 3, and for this line, it's 1/2. Yeah, so if we go to the next scan line, x becomes here, x becomes 4, and this x becomes 1.5. Yeah? 1.5 and 4, and what you also see, these edges have been swapped because now this x value of this edge is smaller than this. Here they were the same, so the sorting didn't make a difference, but now after this update, it sees, okay, this edge is before this edge, so these edges are swapped. Here we have the new x values, and we can immediately now rasterize this line from 1.5 to 4. Now here we will need some rounding. We will see that later on. Okay, and then we continue again, a new scan line. X values are updated, so here 1/2 has been added, and here 4 have been added. So we can fill the scan line from 2 to 7. Yeah, that's all the pixels we have here. And now something interesting also happened, and that is E1 for edge 1. We arrived at the upper part of this edge. Yeah, so we removed E1 from our active edge table, and after that we inserted edge E4, because here now we have reached the lower bound for E4. So the new active edge table contains E2 and E4. And of course the x value here, the starting value of E4, is exactly the same as the end value of E1, because they are linked together. Okay, now E1 is done. Yeah, it can be completely removed, doesn't show up anymore. And we continue using this scan line. And now the new case happens that this edge and this edge will be inserted. But nevertheless, the algorithm continues as shown. Okay. Good. So that's the idea of the scan line algorithm. Yeah, it's not complicated, but it contains many little pieces that will show up in different places in computer graphics. And just to mention that again, if you have a very good GPU or whatever graphics processor on your gaming PC, then there's definitely not directly this algorithm implemented, in particular not with lists, with next pointers and stuff like that. Yeah? There are highly optimized versions of this algorithm where, for instance, for all triangles with a size of less than 4 pixels or so, all different possible corner positions have been pre-rasterized. So nothing has to be enumerated, the pixels can directly be set and stuff like that. Yeah? So there's lots of magic going on here. This is a very basic first algorithm to solve that problem. Okay, so now we know how to enumerate all these pixels. And now if you look at typical computer graphics images, you immediately see, of course, all these triangles that you render don't have the same color. Yeah? So they don't have uniform color. Instead, there's a shading on the triangles. That means that if we go back to this example, there are different colors over the scan line and also from bottom to top. Yeah? So this polygon could be darker here and brighter here and more reddish here, for instance. Yeah? So there's a shading on that triangle. And from the chapter before, where we computed lighting, you know how this can happen. All these pixel centers here correspond to different points in space. Thus, they receive different amounts of light, and the lighting changes. So essentially we would have to do a lighting computation for each of these pixel centers to get a correct color. Yeah? So that is one, it's the most expensive way of doing a shading on that polygon. Yeah, is to do a lighting computation per pixel. And this would be the direct way. But in fact, now again, we have to see that this can become quite expensive. Yeah, and I mean, it's quite simple to make a little computation. Yeah, if you have full HD resolution, that means you have 2 million pixels, and you want to compute 60 frames per second, that means you have to do 120 million lighting computations per second. And that's really a lot. So if you take that Phong model, that includes square roots for normalizing normals, yeah, light directions, view directions. It computes. It contains reflection vector vector directions. It contains a power function. Yeah, so that's quite a as a single computation. It's not much, but if you have to do that 120 million times per second, it is much. And in particular, it was that very much when computer graphics started. So it was just not practical to do that per pixel. And another problem that needs to be solved here, and that we didn't speak about up to now, is if I want to do lighting computation for that pixel here, I need for that pixel the 3D position in space, yeah, in world space. We only have the positions here for the corners. Yeah? So we don't have a position for that point here. And we need a normal at that point. Yeah? You need a surface normal for doing the lighting computation. OK, yeah. So where to get coordinates and normals from? And these are all questions that that are handled in what we call shading. And there are a number of different shading models, or number three. And yeah, let me briefly go through these. So the first one is what is called flat shading. Flat shading is very, very simple way. The idea is not to do shading, but instead for every triangle to use the same color and to do the lighting computations just for a representative point of each face. So we just take the center, for instance, of each face, we do a lighting computation, and then we fill the entire triangle with that color. Yeah, so the triangle gets a constant color. Yeah, of course, that's computationally it's okay because you have one lighting computation per triangle, but it doesn't look good. And there are quite a few effects that make that very visible. So if we look at that teapot model, for instance, that's rendered with flat shading. And even, I think if I turn that light off here, yeah, you immediately see that this doesn't work well. Yeah? This teapot is not a round shape. Geometrically, it looks fine. So the silhouette is round. This is OK. But at the shading, you can clearly see the single triangles. Yeah? And here, for that ball, it's the same. And I mean, it's clear where this comes from, but things become even worse because of properties of the human eye. The human eye is very sensitive to discontinuities in brightness. And yeah, maybe I should better turn off that light again. So if you look at this bar here, this just contains different shades of gray. If you look at that closer, I hope that everybody of you realizes that the impression is that there is a kind of ramp here, that here it's brighter and then it becomes darker. And the same for this box here. This seems to be brighter here and darker here. Yeah? Who doesn't see that? Okay, it's a well-known effect, yeah? And in fact, it's a property of the human eye. It just overemphasizes such discontinuities, so the perceived intensity here at one of these edges is really that before the edge, it becomes darker, and then after the edge, it becomes brighter, and then you perceive the normal intensity. Yeah, so these edges are overemphasized. And this effect, by the way, does not only work for discontinuities in the intensity, but also in the gradient. Yeah. So also intensity changes like this are overemphasized by the eye. Yeah. So they look like this. So the human eye is very, very sensitive to discontinuities or to unsmooth shading. You have to be very careful about that. And here again, this, and yeah, I tried that out here in PowerPoint to show the effect. So typically what you could do is you can get rid of this ramp by putting your finger just in front of this edge so that the edge is covered by your finger. And then it looks much more uniform. Yeah, for me it works. I tried it with that box. But again, this box generates discontinuities here. Yeah, so it doesn't work that well for that case. It was your finger probably works better. Okay. Good. So, we need something smoother. And so flat shading doesn't look good. Doing that per pixel is rather expensive. So a compromise that is still very, very widely used is what is called Gouraud shading. Yeah? And the idea is to generate a shading that is smoother, that looks good, and that is computationally more efficient than doing lighting per pixel. And the idea now is the following. So let's assume we have a surface that looks like this. Yeah? So we have a closed surface. As you know, we represent all such surfaces as a triangle mesh or as a mesh of faces, single faces. And now geometrically that means that we have these facets, yeah, that became well visible for the teapot example. So geometrically we have these, but we kind of want to hide that in the shading. Yeah, we want to have a faceted geometry, but the shading should look like it's curved. And now the idea to do that is the following. So for each of the vertices of our mesh, we take the normals of the surrounding faces and average these. Yeah? So we compute a kind of average normal in that vertex. Now that's a face normal that none of these faces around here will have that face normal. Yeah? It's really just a face normal in between. That's this here. And we do that for every face. Yeah? For every face we assign such a normal. There are different ways to do that. One would simply be to average the normals around. Another one, also easier to compute, by the way, is to weight these normals by the area of the according triangle. So if we have a triangle mesh, to compute the normal for this vertex here, we take the normals of the neighboring triangles and all weight it by the by the area of that triangle. Yeah? So we sum these up and normalize. And this gives us a normal, an average normal for that vertex. And this is quite simple to compute, because maybe you remember, if you have a triangle which is spanned by two vectors, A and B, the normal of this triangle, a normal, can be computed using the cross product. So we can compute A cross B, yeah, the vector product. So that's a vector that is perpendicular to A and B, yeah, thus it's perpendicular to that triangle. And the length of this vector is, yeah, the area of that parallelogram, or twice the area of the triangle. Yeah, so that's the area of this triangle. And yeah, now we exploit this. That means if we just take the cross product of two consecutive such spanning vectors, yeah, if we take that cross product, we immediately get the normal scaled by the area of that corresponding triangle. There's still a factor of two, but that cancels out with the normalization. And now here we can even simplify that further, because now you see here that these pi here are the directly the vertices and not the spanning vectors. And yeah, this can also be shown with some arithmetics that this is exactly the same as taking these spanning vectors. So as a result, you get directly this formula. Just plug in all the points around a vertex, yeah, this one ring around that vertex, take the corresponding cross products, sum it up, normalize, and then you get an average normal. So that's quite simple. Okay, good. So that's not very complicated to compute. And yeah, if you do so, what you get for this teapot is a normal per vertex. Yeah, and this is what we call vertex normals. Okay. Now, the idea of Gouraud shading is to not to do the lighting computation at every pixel that we render, but instead to compute the lighting for every vertex in our triangle mesh. That means whenever we render a triangle, we do a lighting computation at the vertices of that triangle. And for this, we take these vertex normals. Yeah? Now we have for every vertex, we have a normal. So for each of these vertices, we do a lighting computation. Yeah? So we have colors at the vertices. And then when rendering, we just interpolate these vertex colors over the triangle. Yeah? So we get a shading on the triangle. And depending on our interpolation, typically we only use linear interpolation, we get a linear shading on the triangle. So that's quite simple. So we perform lighting, typically Phong lighting or whatever other, Torrent Sparrow or what you prefer, at the vertices using these vertex normals, and then we do a linear interpolation. And in fact, this is probably even faster than flat shading, because it can be shown that in at least in large, reasonable meshes, there are only half as many vertices as faces. Yeah? So we have less vertices than faces. That means for that we need less lighting computations than for flat shading. In flat shading, we do lighting per face, and here we do lighting per vertex. But the additional price, now we have to do an interpolation during rasterization. And we will have a look at that in a minute, yeah, how we can extend our scanline algorithm that we just learned so that in parallel we also interpolate colors while doing the rasterization. Okay, so how does that work? So let's assume now again we have this triangle, I1, I2, or this face here that we want to render. Now before rendering the triangle, we do a lighting computation at the vertices, yeah? And so with every vertex, we get a color that comes from the lighting computation. Yeah? So each of these vertices here has a color now that comes from a lighting computation. And then we somehow have to interpolate. Yeah? We have this triangle. We have colors at the vertices. And now when doing the scanline algorithm, yeah, and for instance setting this pixel, we need a color that interpolates these colors here at the corners. And yeah, again shown here, so this is our scanline. We fill from this point to this point. Yeah, now we need colors for filling, and yeah, this is not difficult. It's at least by doing only simple linear interpolation, we can interpolate the colors along this edge. Yeah, when doing the rasterization, we interpolate from here to here, so this gives us a color here, simple linear interpolation. We interpolate from here to here, this gives us this color, And when we fill this scan line here, we just interpolate from IA to AB. Yeah? So it's a kind of doing linear interpolation twice. So be careful, this is not bilinear. That's still linear. It's a typical trap. Bilinear would be on a quad. Here we are on a triangle. Yeah, so that's a linear interpolation that we get here. And one thing, yeah, that could be considered here. We will also come back to that later in another context where it's much more relevant. Since we do that during rasterization, that means we do the interpolation in screen space. And that's different from doing the interpolation in world space if we have perspective. We will come back to that later. But this is very simple. In screen space, we interpolate. Okay. Yeah, so how can this be done? I hope that you're all able to do simple linear interpolation. So if we have... Partly cannot see it here. So if we have this situation here, now we are here in this upper triangle. The intensity here at A, and I'm sorry, I mixed up I and L here a bit. Yeah. So I wanted to change it to L, but forgot to do that in these images. Yeah. So these are exactly the same, I and L. So LA, the intensity here, yeah, is, yeah, different ways to describe that. I would say it's this intensity plus the fraction how far we went to this direction times the difference between these two. Yeah, it's, yeah, very simple linear interpolation done here on the y coordinate because our scan line algorithm works on the y coordinate. Yeah, this fraction tells us how far we are on the way from here to here. And this fraction is exactly taken to take these differences and give us an intensity here. The same on the right. And if we have intensities here and here, and we have a particular point here, we do interpolation in x direction, and we get this value. OK, now that's, if you look at that, yeah, it's still quite some arithmetic. We have a fraction here, a division, several differences. This can be pre-computed per edge. At least, no, this can be pre-computed per edge. This can be pre-computed per edge. So there are some things that could be pre-computed. But nevertheless, we will see that there are faster ways to do that. So here again, schematic overview about this interpolation, and again the remark that this interpolation here is done in screen space and not in world space. That is a difference. And it's for shading, it's not that obvious, but for other things it becomes very obvious. Okay, and now, as I said, there's still quite some arithmetic involved, but now the nice thing is that since the entire process is linear, we can do that incrementally like we do the update of the x-coordinate in the scanline algorithm. You remember when we pushed the scanline upwards to increment or to compute the new x, we just added 1 over m. And exactly the same trick we can use now for our shading. So that means when we start with that edge here, for instance, yeah, we set a color, or we remember a color with that edge. Yeah, that is in the beginning, it's here, this intensity of that edge. And whenever moving upwards one scan line, we compute a little increment so that whenever we move up the scan line, we only have to add that increment. Yeah? And this increment has to be selected in a way that in the end we arrive at I1 or L1. And for this edge, if we are up here, we arrive at L3. Yeah, and so we don't have to compute any fractions or so. It's just a very simple addition. Yeah, so whenever we move up the scan line, we increment LA by this term here. That can simply be derived from the formula before. And for LB, it's this fraction. So Practically, that means that, I don't have this active edge table anymore. So in the active edge table, we had this intersection value. We had the upper bound for y to know when we can finish, and we had this value 1 over m. And whenever we incremented the scan line, what we did is that we updated x intersect by 1 over m. And what we do now is that additionally, we remember a color, so that's the current color of this intersection point. Yeah. This is the scan line. Now here we have a color, and of course an x value. Yeah. And if we go to the next scan line, we increment x by 1 over m. Yeah, so this distance is 1 over m. And at the same time, we update the color. Yeah, color intersection plus some delta c. And this delta c also must be stored in the active edge table and can be pre-computed. OK, now things are completely messed up. Yeah? So it's very simple. For each of these edges, we remember such a color increment here, and we simply add this to the current color. Yeah, so in our active edge table now, we also have a color, and when this is our current scan line, we can immediately look up the color of this point and of this point, and when now setting all the pixels in between, we can do exactly the same. We can again compute an increment that we have to add when we go from pixel at position x to pixel at position x plus 1. Yeah? So again, we can step through and by simple updates compute new colors. Yeah? That's only possible because we do a linear interpolation. Okay, so that's simple. The algorithm doesn't become much more complicated, so that works nicely and is also very often used. It's really still the default mode in most renderers. But nevertheless, it can generate artifacts. And if you're a bit used to that, you can quickly recognize them. And in particular, you get problems if you have glossy surfaces. Yeah? Surfaces with Phong lighting with a high specular coefficient and a large exponent. That means small highlights, very glossy surfaces. Because what happens now, or what can happen here? Let's, for instance, say, this is a curved surface, and now we represent that using triangles. Yeah? So we have a triangle that goes from here to here. Yeah, so this is a planar triangle. And here's the next one, and here's the next one. Now we do the lighting computations only at the vertices. Yeah? And now for such a glossy surface, it can easily happen that at this position, there should be a highlight, such a glossy highlight as we can see here. But unfortunately, there's no vertex here. Yeah? So at this position, no lighting computation is made. It is made here and here. But they are so far away from the highlight that this vertex says, I'm dark. This vertex says, I'm dark. Yeah. So the entire triangle only has dark vertices. And when doing interpolation, the entire triangle becomes dark. And the highlight in the center gets lost. Yeah. So if we have such a triangle, and there should be a highlight here, this will be missed. Because this doesn't show the highlight, this one doesn't, and this one doesn't. Yeah, so highlights disappear. And now if we, for instance, change the position of the light source, what can happen is that this highlight moves up, and then it suddenly hits a vertex. Yeah? So now this highlight is found, but the effect is that this is dark, and now this is very bright, and doing the interpolation, the highlight becomes much bigger than it would be in reality. Now it's overemphasized. Yeah? So that's this example here. So if you have a triangle, here's a highlight, and now this the vertex of this triangle hits that highlight, then this highlight or this triangle becomes much brighter than it should be. And yeah, this leads to kind of flickering effect, in particular if you move objects, yeah, you see highlights disappearing and appearing brighter and getting brighter and darker and stuff like that. And this is pretty annoying. And it also reveals again the triangle structure, yeah, because suddenly you realize this pattern of the underlying triangles and stuff like that. Okay, but on the other hand, if you don't have very specular surfaces and or little triangles where this effect is less noticeable, then Gourou shading works very fine, in particular for diffuse surfaces, for instance. Yeah, it doesn't make a difference to more complicated methods. Okay, good. So that's Gourou shading. And now, finally, we have Phong shading. Now, don't mix this up with Phong lighting. Phong shading now is just a more complicated way to do shading that generates better results, and it's essentially the kind of shading that I explained to you in the chapter before. Here the idea now is that for every pixel that we render, we do a complete lighting computation. Yeah? So we really do the lighting computation per pixel, so this is also typically called per pixel lighting. And yeah, it's only because it's computationally more expensive, it's really a feature that with graphics cards only came up in the last 10 years maybe. Yeah. It's already a long time ago yet, but okay. And Phong shading now means two things. So for every point, for every pixel that we render, we need a position in 3D space, yeah, to be able to do the lighting computation, and we need a normal. And how can we do that? Again, we do the same as we did for Gourou shading. Again, we compute a normal per vertex. So if this is our triangle that we want to render, we compute a normal for every vertex. And these can vary. Yeah? So imagine this is a triangle that represents a part of a sphere. Then obviously at the vertices, yeah, you have diverging normals. So we have these normals here. And now when doing rasterization, at this point here, we want to do a lighting computation. So we need the 3D position in space. Yeah, so that's X. That's still doable to get that. And a bit more difficult is we need a normal here, yeah, for lighting. And this normal should, again, be interpolated between these normals here. Yeah. And in fact, the idea now of Phong shading is to use the exactly same method that we used here for colors to interpolate normals. So at that point, we also interpolate normals here to get an interpolated normal here. And then we take this interpolated normal and do a lighting computation. Yeah? So it's very simple. The only difference here, we interpolate intensities. And we interpolate normals and then do the normal the lighting computation. Okay, again, yeah, normals at the vertices, and for a particular point P, we interpolate these normals here, and we do that exactly in the same way like we interpolated intensities here. Oh, sorry, that. Okay, if I remember that, I will fix that. But it's I mean, yeah, it's quite obvious. Yeah, it's all linear interpolation. Yeah, computer graphics is linear interpolation. So if you know how to interpolate linearly, you know how to do computer graphics. If you don't know how to interpolate linearly, and that's maybe a hint also for the axiom, yeah, then obviously you don't know how to do computer graphics. So good. Yeah, so we can interpolate normals. There's one thing with normals that is that needs to be considered here. That is that a normal has length 1, or should have length 1. So if we have a scan line like this, and here we have this normal, and here we have this normal, yeah, in the middle, we interpolate these two normals, and this results in this vector. And if you look at that a bit more closely, you will see that the length of this vector is smaller than 1, yeah? So it's not normalized. So after interpolation, normal vectors have to be normalized. Yeah. Again, given length 1. So this is a very, very simple way to interpolate normals. And in fact, for those of you who hear the computer animation lecture, which is only in the master, I think, you will learn that this is not the best way to interpolate normals. There are better ways, doing spherical interpolation that doesn't have this problem. But yeah, it's just more complicated. You need sine and cosine. Yeah? And for our purpose, that's just fine. Doing linear interpolation on normals, but that means that they have to be renormalized. Okay, so what's the result? The result is that we have better quality, in particular for glossy surfaces. Highlights look much better, much smoother. We don't have these problems with disappearing highlights. But we also have higher costs, so the interpolation of normals costs time. I mean, you don't see that typically, because in the shader programs that you write in the programming tutorials, you don't have to do that interpolation. You directly get an interpolated normal. But nevertheless, there are many circuits on these chips, yeah, that do this interpolation for you. And at least they require power. And renormalization is necessary. That's a square root. And a square root is quite costly to evaluate. And you typically have many more lighting computations than you would have to do for Gouraud shading. OK, and do not mix up Phong shading and Phong lighting. It's the same Phong, but he contributed these two ideas. OK, now here a few pictures, again, showing the difference. These pictures are quite old, but a kind of standard to define these different techniques. So this picture shows a simple scene with constant shading. Constant shading, we didn't even describe that, just means every object has a color, and simply render that object in that color. Yeah, so there's not a single lighting computation going on here. Then flat shading means do a single color lighting computation per face. Yeah, so obviously this torus does not, so it should be a ring. Yeah, so it does not only have geometrical problems, but also the shading is crap, also for the teapot here. Now this is Gouraud shading without specular highlights. Gouraud shading with specular highlights. Yeah. So here you can see, for instance, that highlights don't look good. And yeah, this is Phong shading with highlights. So you see the teapot. Yeah. You see the difference. Looks much better. Also here, for instance, here the highlight is overemphasized. And here that's also Gouraud shading. Yeah, this highlight and how it really should look like. And I find that part funny here because it's still the geometry is completely wrong, but it has the shading of a very round thing. Of course here the geometry should also be much rounder. Okay. Good. So Now this shading is, as I said, is quite simple. And I always said that it's linear. And in fact, this is not completely true. I should have said that if we have as underlying geometry a triangle, yeah, then the shading is linear. What does linear mean in that context? So if we have intensities here, I1, I2, I3, and we interpret these intensities as a third coordinate, as a set coordinate, then the resulting surface would be a plane. Yeah? So we take the intensities as an additional coordinate. So yeah, this is pretty dark, so it's on the blackboard. This is brighter, so it sticks further out, and this even further out. So you have 3 points, and you can put a plane through it, and this gives you an intensity on each of these points. Yeah? So that's linear interpolation. And yeah, that can be easily derived, that you also have this linear interpolation if you first do a linear interpolation on this edge, and then on this edge, and then on here, in a result that's still linear, as long as you have a triangle. If you don't have a triangle, but something more complicated, then this interpolation scheme, as I described here, can generate very strange effects. I will come back to that example later. This can be shown here. If we have such a quadrilateral, yeah, A, B, C, D, and we look at that particular scan line, yeah, then we will find out that the shading of a particular point depends on its rotation. So let's, for example, look at, I should have marked a particular point here. Let's look at some point here, or you will also do that in one of the exercises. Yeah. So all in this, here in the left example, the color within the triangle ABD, yeah, only depends on the colors of A, B, and D, obviously. Yeah? Because C has no influence anymore. This edge, when we come to this scan line, all edges emanating from C are already finished. Yeah? So when we render any point in here, C has no influence. But if we look at this picture, for instance, yeah, a point here still is influenced by C. Yeah? So obviously, a color of this point under this rotation, yeah, and this point, these are the same points, but depending on the rotation of the object, you get a different shading result. So if you just rotate the object, the shading within the triangle or within the object changes. So there will be an example in the exercises. Where you can see that, yeah, and that's an effect, of course, that's very undesirable. But in practice, we don't have that problem that much because we really only render triangles, and whenever you render a polygon or a polygon with more than 3 vertices, these are typically subdivided into triangles at first, and then these are rendered, and then this effect doesn't appear anymore, because if we subdivide, for instance, here, along the edge BD, then this effect won't appear anymore because there will be an additional edge in between, and then this point has no influence from C anymore because this new edge BD controls that. Okay, so that's one effect. Another point that should be considered is that we have to be a bit careful with the definition of our geometry. I think I already mentioned that also, and that we should avoid cases like this one. So what we see here is 3 faces. And now the point is that here's a vertex, yeah, that is part of this and of this face, but not of face one. So face one also has four vertices, this one, and this one. And C happens to be on the direct connection between A and B. Yeah, so there's geometrically, there's no hole, but topologically we have a little problem here, and we call that hanging node, yeah, or a T-vertex, because the shape here is a T. Yeah. And now, geometrically, this is no problem. But with all these interpolation methods, what we will see is that this edge here will become visible as a discontinuity in shading. Just because when interpolating from A to B to get the value of C for the triangle on the left, we will very likely get a different result as the vertex C here has directly. Yeah? So that's a we will later on see other examples where such hanging nodes can result in yeah, visible problems. So avoid these nodes. Okay. Good. So so much for rasterization of polygons. And yeah, this is the probably most important algorithm for rasterization. But there's another sub-problem, and I think the algorithm is also very interesting. And in fact, it can be combined with scanline rasterization. And yeah, I think it must be part of every computer graphics lecture. And the algorithm is an algorithm to draw lines between two points. And in fact, it is, I mean, it can be considered as a subproblem of the scanline algorithm, because when we rasterize such a triangle, of course, the left edge here, yeah, is a rasterization of the line from here to here. Yeah? So rasterizing a triangle is rasterizing the edges and kind of filling that. Yeah? So it's line rasterization is a subproblem. And now here we will learn a very simple algorithm that solves this problem, and it does it in a very elegant way, because in contrast to what we do here for scanline rasterization, it completely avoids computations with floating point numbers. So it only does integer computations. So that means if it comes to doing that in hardware, for instance, it's much, much simpler to do that because integer arithmetic is much, much simpler than floating point arithmetic is. Yeah? And for scanline, all these entries, these are all floating point values, yeah, here in particular, and this x-intersection and so on. Okay, so yeah, I think I will start with a motivation, and then we can do the algorithm on Thursday. So the idea is always we start, or we have to we want to compute a line or rasterize a line between a point x0, y0 to x1, y1. And now we want to set a number of pixels in between. They should all be along this line and kind of give a connected or a connection in between, so there should be no holes and so on. But if we look at that, we immediately see it's not quite obvious what we really want to compute. So for instance, do we want to compute every pixel that touches this line? So that would mean we have to set this pixel and this pixel and this, and maybe here this and this and this. Yeah. So that would be a rather thick line. Or do we want to, yeah, what other criteria could we find? Yeah, which pixels to set that define this line? So we will see that in a minute. Because so this question becomes important because the visual thickness of the line in the end very strongly depends on how we define the pixels that need to be set. Yeah, so we ideally we want to have a uniform thickness so that a line appears uniform, or the thickness appears uniform independent of the direction of the line. We also don't want to have gaps, of course, in our lines. And, of course, we want to have that very fast. And so this would be one solution, as it will generate the algorithm that we will learn probably on Thursday then. And what you see here is that we simply, for every pixel, we always go one to the right, and then depending on the slope or on the position relative to the line, we either go to the right or we go to the right and upwards. Yeah. So we, for every step, or whenever we have a pixel, the next pixel on the line is either on the right or on the upper right. Yeah. So we only have two different cases that we have to distinguish. So this gives a connected line. How we decide about in which direction to go, we will learn later. But this gives a connected line, at least. It is rather thin, yeah? Because, for instance, you see this pixel is touched by the line, but it's not set, yeah? And it's only touched marginally. So it has a good reason not to set that. But one disadvantage is that if you draw a diagonal line, yeah, with a 45-degree angle, relatively few pixels are set compared to a line that is horizontally. So the thickness criterion would not be very well fulfilled. Yeah. Okay, but nevertheless, what we do for now is that we say for a line like this here, we always go one pixel in x direction, and then we find the one pixel in y direction that closest lies on this line. That's kind of the definition, what we want to do for our next algorithm. Yeah, and this again a difference. Yeah, this would be all the pixels touched by the line. So this line is visually too thick, and by only taking the criterion as we said now, the thinnest approximation, we get this one. This is also not perfect, but it's a very reasonable definition. And now if you start playing with that, you will quickly find, okay, there are certain cases that are very simple. For instance, horizontal lines, of course, vertical lines, also a 45-degree slope. Is quite simple, yeah, because it's just always going northeast, yeah, always taking this one case. And other slopes also, for special cases you can always find good solutions. So if we have a slope of 1/2, we could always go once to east, northeast, east, northeast, east, northeast, east, yeah. So by this we get a slope of 1/2. But of course for the general case that's more complicated, and how this can be done, we will see. It's the Brasenham algorithm, and we will learn that then on Thursday. Thank you.